Hey, what's up, investors? Looking over to the news, I stumbled upon this article put out by Realtor Magazine. And at that point, you should probably raise an eyebrow because the realtors are always putting out useless knowledge out there. They had this article talking about Taylor Swift is even influencing home prices. And basically, they used a bunch of data to create correlation or causation, saying that whatever her Eras tour was going, you saw a little bit of a pop of real estate prices. They call it the Taylor effect. And maybe it's just that time of the year where they just put out whatever, or they're just using SEO to ride the wave of Taylor Swift. But we brought on Roger Blackwell on this week's podcast to really talk about what are the bigger themes that are happening out there. And I still think, despite this big tidal wave of loans maturing over the next year, you're still seeing that real estate is a great place long term. Now, it depends what kind of investor you are out there. If you're somebody who is just wants to come in out 6 months, a few years, then you may want to pay attention to what these little headlines say. But if you're an investor who has enough net worth to really ride the 10-year plus waves, it's a lot easier way and a lot more stress-free way of investing. That said, there will be a little bit of a headwinds this next year, and I'll talk a lot about this in my upcoming quarterly newsletter. If you guys want to get that webinar, you can go to thewealthelevator.com/club to get signed up there. But a great article in globevest.com. And I'll send this article out to all of you guys who are added onto the newsletter. But it's not very long, but it goes over some big things that will be happening next year. The economy will be slowing down. It will not be clicking at 4% GDP. Why? Because the entire 2022-23, there's been interest rate increases, and we have yet to really see the impacts of them. Sure, there might be a soft landing, but there will be a slowdown. Some of the challenges in specifically commercial real estate is a wave of deliveries, new inventory coming online, and this will limit the amount of rising rents that somebody's going to be able to expect because of this new inventory coming online. Now, the good news long term, and when long term, 3, 5 years, 10 years plus, is that there's still this fundamental shortage of housing, especially in the lower middle class sector, which we like to play in. Going forward, there's been a bit of a clearing these past couple of years. And if you're a new investor, this is a great time to be in investing right now. Previously, the tide lifted all boats. And why? Because there was a lot of good debt out there that essentially free money. And now that free money is not going to be around. Before, you're able to get very low interest on 70% loan-to-value loans. Now, getting even 55-60% loan-to-value loans at moderate rates is going to be difficult these next year or two. Is real estate a still great place to be in? Yeah, because it's a hard asset and you get great tax benefits. But it's not going to be an easy lift-all-tides sector anymore. Now, we'll talk a little about in the coming weeks. I've got some written content for you guys talking about buying businesses, private equity, which I think a lot of people are moving into that sector with real estate kind of being in a place where you've really got to walk very carefully around this next few quarters. I, for one, am still going to play in real estate is what I've decided, right? Because this is where our deal flow is, this is where our connections are. And at the end of the day, real estate provides a fundamental value and utility to humanity, and it is a hard asset. The good news is that there is the light at the end of the tunnel. The Fed is expected to drop rates, or maybe worst case, keep it where it's at for a longer time. But what we know now is that there is that light. This is no longer how it was in late 2022 and 2023. We didn't know how high the rates would go. In some respect, even if the rates don't come down, there is a level of stability there. At least it's not going to get any worse from this point on. And that is enough for things to really loosen up in terms of capital markets and lending. We've got some cool stuff coming up. Of course, you guys need to be part of the investor group to get access, as we can't really speak about it on the podcast form. But again, I urge everybody, there's going to be a bunch of shifting around. There's going to be a lot of investors just frozen in their places. The best thing is to get educated, learn about syndications and private placements, and more importantly, get around other people doing this stuff too. And really fixate on some of the long-term fundamentals that we're going to be talking about in today's podcast. We're really looking forward to a lot of you guys coming to Las Vegas, looking back on my personal finance journey getting up to this point. still a lot of place for me to go personally. For me, looking back in 2016 was when I really started to meet other investors. And a lot of those people were the ones who I still interact with today. And really, we grew together. I urge everybody to get around other people doing this stuff and to really build relationships. Maybe you've been investing in rental properties on your own. That's great. But again, that's what I did. And my growth was very stunted until I started to meeting other investors doing the same stuff. And I just wanted to mention that because I had a lot of discussions with new investors getting lined up for 2024 and booking their complimentary onboarding calls. Now, I would really suggest you doing very soon before the new year really gets going. But yeah, this investor, they've been going down the rabbit hole for about a few months now, just now learning about all the tax benefits, about using the passive losses to offset their passive income and potentially their ordinary income with real estate professional status and investing directly in real thriving businesses backed by hard assets such as real estate and provide great utility, such as just renting out this spaces out as opposed to investing in the stock market. But most people start to get 3 to 6 months into this diving down the alternative investment rabbit hole, you start to really realize what a big world this is. I would say just keep at it, booked an onboarding call so I can point you in the right direction, and then put your head down in our e-courses, specifically our syndication LPE course. And at that point, you can really expedite getting yourself to a point where you can start investing and meeting other people. It just starts off with making that personal connection out there. With that, enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast with Dr. Roger Blackwell, who used to be a former Ohio State University marketing professor and an acclaimed author. His latest book, Objective Prosperity, is currently on Amazon right now. Go and check it out. He's previously consulted for Walmart. I'm part of a group called Visage, which is a business mastermind for owners and CEO level. And he came in, gave us a great talk, and I asked him to tailor the talk more for our audience of passive investors out there. We're going to be talking about macroeconomics, of course, interest rates, and where's more long term, where's the economy going with AI and the workforce and population? But yeah, thanks for jumping on, Roger. I really appreciate coming on.
Oh, glad to be here.
Let's get diving right into it. The reason why I wanted to bring on somebody like yourself is investors, they get lost in interest rates and they fail to lose sight of the big picture, right? What are the things to invest in that are going to be 10, 20, 30 years still here? Nevertheless, let's talk about interest rates. How do you see the current macroeconomic trends impacting real estate market today?
If you look at the trends from an objective perspective, the economy is pretty good. People are buying more than ever. We've just come through the highest buying seasons and months. People are afraid about the future and they're apprehensive about what the future brings. But that's partly because interest rates affect the stock market. And you hear a lot about the stock market, but the stock market's been doing pretty good. You can argue that the valuations of stocks is on the high side these days. And so basically, we don't expect the stock market to go up a lot, but we don't expect a major depression. Everybody understands the difference between a recession and depression. A recession is when somebody who lost their job because of the economy. A depression is when you lose your job. And we don't see a depression. We see the fact that inflation is the real elephant in the room. And how do you control inflation? The answer is to get people stop buying so much. You have inflation anytime that what people buying is going up faster than what their incomes are. And that's what's happening. And people are buying, they're using credit, and the credit cards and delinquencies are a concern. But still, people have lots of unused buying power. And so they're still buying. Now, some people would say what you need is a good recession to cure that. Then people wouldn't buy so much. And that is true, but it's not what we want. We would like to have people continue buying a little bit, but not enough to cause a major recession. The economy, unemployment, lowest unemployment ever. Not ever, but almost the lowest. And jobs, we're creating more jobs. Now, some of the big firms, like some Seattle firms and others, are laying off people, but the newer, more emerging firms are gobbling them up because they can't get enough workers. So there's no real difficulty of getting a job. It's the fact that inflation makes jobs feel not so good. Income has actually gone up a little bit over the last two decades, but not a lot. But what has gone up is what people want, and that's gone up even faster. Because when we look at inflation, we look at the price of cars. They've gone up, but they also have added cameras. Everybody's got a backup camera now. They've added all kinds of navigation systems and security systems and all these sorts of things. And now, if you want to buy a new car, you're almost forced to buy all those things. I remember when I bought my first car, you know why people say roll up the window today when we just push a button? Because that's what you used to have to do, is roll up the window. Now we expect that. And expectations go up faster than income. And demand goes up faster than production. And that's why we have inflation.
I'll add an anecdote in there. It used to be you could buy your kid, or if you wanted a cheap car, get a Honda Civic for about, I don't know, 15, 20 grand. Now you can't find any of those things, and they're all like 30, 35. And like you said, the cameras make you buy that stuff. And it's the high end. It used to be the $50,000 Mercedes, used to be the iconic item. Now those things have come down in price. And now you're looking between the high end $39,000 Honda Civic and the low end Mercedes at 45, right? That's an interesting dynamic.
And we know that it costs a lot more to have an EV car than it does an ICE car. And yet we're almost forced into getting EV. Not exactly forced. We're given incentives with government payments for it and things like that. But in some states like California are arguing it should be enforced. We shouldn't be able to buy internal combustion engines anymore. And so we impose that on consumers, and there's no free lunch. It's one of the things you learn about economics. There's really no free lunch. And so if you give people money or force them to buy all kinds of things on their cars, like seatbelts, my first car not only didn't have electric motors for the windows, I had to install bolts into the frame of the car and put the seatbelts on. We keep changing what people want. And so that's why economics is changing, not so much to the old Keynesian models, but the new ones that add psychology and sociology and demographics. And when we look at jobs and prices of everything, you've got to look at demographics, because demographics determine about 2/3 of everything in life. Look at our health. Demographics have a lot to do with that. And it has a lot to do with jobs and a lot to do with what we expect in a car.
Most definitely. I think like one thing I always come back to in our business masterminds that I'm in, we always say, man, is it like we're paying these guys way too much? And I think most recently, there's this big battle. Employers want their employees to come back to the office, which has implications with office in asset class. But mostly I'm bringing it up because the wage inflation is very high. So I guess the question here is chicken and egg thing. Is it the fact that there's too much money in the system, or is it the wages that is the driver for inflation?
There are several causes of inflation. And if anybody took an economics class among your listeners and weren't sleeping through it, which is often happens, they know that there are various causes of recession and there are various causes of inflation. And one of those causes is when is called the wage price spiral. When prices go up, people want their wages to go up. And so then people have to raise the prices, and that's why we get into inflation. And we could handle a little inflation every year. In fact, the Federal Reserve wants 2%. It's about 3% currently. And until it gets below 3%, the Federal Reserve will keep the screw on tight to interest rates, meaning high, and interest rates affect housing. They affect construction of new plants and everything else. But there used to be a commercial called pay me now or pay me later. And that's the way it is with inflation. Do you pay off the inflation price now, or do you see it keep getting worse and worse in the future? And that's what the Federal Reserve has to try to control. But actually, that's monetary policy. Fiscal policy is how much Congress spends. And when Congress spends a lot more than it takes in, the same thing that happens to the families when they do that happens to the government. And that's what's happening right now.
One of the big items that I think that's trend we've seen this past year is ChatGPT AI. Here's my personal things on it. I don't think that it's going to totally change the entire landscape. Certain things, certain industries, writers and those coders, the things that you can pretty much do over and over again, I think you're still going to need a human, especially to verify it. But long term, there is going to be some displacement. Maybe can you talk a little bit about how is this going to, some trends that this is going to impact? And I think in your talk, you also gave some great examples from other countries, right? That maybe the U.S. kind of follows those trends.
Yeah, actually, if you study the history of countries over the years, there was a group several hundred years ago called the Luddites, and they were very concerned about what happened in England about 400 years ago. They invented the steam engine, which means instead of making everything from wool and in the homes, they moved to the cities and made them in factories. And they were destroying jobs for all these people, both men and women, but in different ways, at home making wool. The British were famous for wool, but it was all made by hand at home. And now these machines destroyed their jobs. Tens of thousands of people put out of work. So the Luddites, some guy by the name of Ludd, led them into taking access and going in and destroying the factories where they were doing that. What happened? Did all those women and men become unemployed? No, they found different jobs. The history of technological advance shows that individuals lose their jobs, but more jobs are created, and usually they're better jobs. That's why the economy keeps getting better century after century, country after country. And if that doesn't happen, the country doesn't prosper. So the technology displaces some people. So what does that mean for the people that's displaced? And the answer is they've got to have the kinds of values that will get the new jobs. A lot of people say, I don't want to learn coding. I don't want to learn about AI. I'm just seeing my job going away. And their jobs will go away, but there will be more and better jobs. So the individuals who change themselves to be ready for the future, wonderful life, a better life. And the ones who don't, not so good. And that's the message always. I've been on the boards of quite a few factory companies. One of them was in Virginia. It was a union operation making furniture. Very high labor rates, but more important were the work rules of the union. And so what happened is the company, actually, just before I went on the board, said, we can't be competitive. So we got to do something else. And they went to Indonesia and built the factory there because it was a wood product and they made it out of teak. So it makes more sense just to make it in that country because the labor rates were very low. However, the logistics and the fact that labor transit rates are higher for assembled furniture than it is raw wood, that didn't work either. So they finally moved the factory back to Mississippi, where there were a lot of good workers who were not in unions, but they knew how to run lathes and all these sorts of things. And they had good jobs in Mississippi, but they lost jobs in Virginia. And the people in Mississippi benefited from that. Now, the people in Virginia who were diligent, I started to say smart enough, but most everybody's smart enough. If they were diligent enough to change their skills, they learned how to program those machines and how to learn accounting and other skills that were needed in the office instead of turning the lathes themselves. That's what you learn from looking at the history. And those are facts. But they always said demand is a function of price holding constant all the other variables. And the people who understand those other variables are the ones who win. And the people who don't lose. Charlie Munger died recently. He read probably more books than any other person in business, which is what made him rich. He went from a very modest background to very rich. If you look at the Bill Gates, the Steve Jobs, the Sam Waldens, the Michael Dells, the Jamie Dimons, how did they get rich? None of them were born rich. They got it by reading books. Because if you're working in a factory someplace and the guy next to you or the gal next to you is not reading them, it's something they don't know. And so you will be the winner in the future and they won't. So
I'm gonna push back here a little bit, Roger. Okay. As an investor, when I look at things, I always look at demographics, right? There's paradigms. There's the white collar folks who live in the high end luxury stuff. And then there's a blue collar, which is why we invest here, is that's the majority of America. when you look at like the workers, for example, I think there is a dichotomy between how the workforces will transform on the blue collar side and the white collar side. I remember there's one thing in our talk that we had earlier about on the blue collar side, the example you gave was the forklift guy. One of the biggest jobs that are in demand in the blue collar world, which ideally they live in our apartments, are like them getting their commercial driver's license, their CDLs. And there's a huge shortage for that. And if they want to improve themselves, they're not going to read a book, in my opinion. All these books are a fluff to them. They need to go get a dang license to improve themselves and then maybe take it up from there.
Sure. That's what I would call focused education. Right now, Walmart's starting over the road truck drivers at $107,000 a year. Okay. How many college degrees do you need to be a truck driver? You don't, but you need a CDL. And actually, Walmart will pay for their retail workers who are making much less to go back. They'll pay for the CDL. It takes about 6 to 12 weeks, depending on the state and everything, the school. And a lot of people say, I don't want to be a truck driver. Okay, you don't want to make $107,000. I just saw that the new UP standard contract is an average salary of $170,000 a year. Anybody who can learn to drive a truck can make $170,000. They're not going to make $170,000 a year working in the same factory. In 1950, about 45% of all our non-farm workers in the U.S. were working in factories. Today, it's about 8, and it's going to go down. If you expect to work in the factory and not change what you're capable of doing, you shouldn't expect to keep up and won't. And one of the readers of our book sent me a thing, and he said, you nailed it when you said, it's not education or IQ that determines who wins, it's diligence. And diligence actually determines who gets education. And we talk about education. Why do people who make more money usually have more education? Because they were diligent enough to get it. I've been in companies, and my first job was 50 cents a week, 50 cents an hour working for a radio station as janitor. Okay. 5 years later, I ended up being chief engineer, getting my degree. They gave me a first-class engineering license. Anybody could have done it, but most of the other people that started working as a janitor didn't do that. It's up to the individual. One of the best books around is Clayton Christensen's book, The Prosperity Paradox. He looked at India, Mexico, Nigeria. His co-author is from Nigeria. Why are some countries more prosperous than others? Several reasons, but one of those reasons is because there's opportunity for upward mobility. And that doesn't just happen. You don't get lucky. It doesn't take any more to you plan. The only people who are successful are those who plan to be. Yeah, I suppose you can win the lottery, but there's a safer plan than the lottery. It's called diligence, hard work. The best neurosurgeon in the world, most people would say, is Dr. Ben Carson. How did he get to? He didn't know his father. He was in a very disadvantaged area of the city. His mother could barely read. She raised Dr. Carson and his brother, but she took him to the library regularly, made them check out books that interested him, bring them home and read her to her because she wasn't able to read. You can be black, one of the poorest families in the nation, and today he's the top neurosurgeon in the world, actually attempted to run for president last time. That's how people do it. Now, I don't just say education. I say focused education. It could be a trade. It could be how to do AI. It could be executives in companies who know how to code, on average, according to a Harvard Business Study, make 25% more than executives who don't. Even those executives never use coding themselves. How much more do you know than other people? That's what will determine where you will be 10 years from now.
I think that's correct, right? Like skill sets that are needed. I think coding is becoming something where AI can do to some extent. And maybe we might have some upset listeners right now who are computer science majors. But as the business owner and the person who employs people, I will say that when I look at employees, the most important thing is being able to synergize and connect with others. Those are the things that AI cannot do. And I think those are the rare skill sets that will be compensated. But I think overall, when we're talking about white collar, blue collar, what I took away from your talk was this general idea of the lower trades people, sure, they can improve themselves, get different licenses and get those higher paid jobs. And then the white collar workers, it seems like those salaries are coming down, right? You called this, the whole pyramid is compressing. in a way.
Well, you're right. Actually, in the last 3 years, the lower income people salaries have gone up faster than the white collar upper end people. Now, the upper ones are still much higher, but it's been going up faster in the lowest 20% of the population than it has in the top people. There are a lot of people say, oh, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poor. Actually, the rich are getting richer, yes, but the poor are getting richer too. Right now, they're getting richer faster than the people at the top. But the white collar, blue collar, that's over. It's, we say gray collar, it's services where the money is. It used to be that 70% of everybody who worked in this country, we're talking about 150 years ago, worked on the farm. Today, it's 2%. So are we producing anything on farms today? Of course. Oh, we're producing more than ever. We're the breadbasket of the world. But we're not needing as many people to do that. What happened to all those 70% of the population that used to be farmers? They didn't go broke. They didn't starve. They found ways to do other things. We're 80% of all jobs are services now. Yes, there's still some human manufacturing, but robots, and I prefer to call them kubots. If you go into a Chick-fil-A today or a White Castle or any place else, your food is served you by a human, but it's brought from the kitchen by a robot. And somebody has to program those robots. Somebody has to maintain them. White Castle is one of those chains, the oldest chain in America for food. I don't know whether your listeners have been to White Castles or not.
Yeah, for people who know the groundbreaking movie Harold and Kumar, this is the place where they went late at night when they were stoned to get some burgers.
They went to New Jersey.
But yeah, recently, as you mentioned, like they're starting to use these robots to flip the burgers. And it's a great example of, sure, that person got paid, what, $8 an hour at one point. But if they get rid of them and they have an operator, maybe they can pay that one person $15, which is still cheaper than having the four or five people that they needed.
Yeah, I have been into a White Castle where they have one worker there who works 23 hours out every day, 7 days a week. His name is Flippy. And Flippy is, of course, a robot. Now, the interesting thing is, you're right, at one time it was $8 an hour. Now it's $15, or probably more than that now, for the people who are still working side by side the robot. And that's the way it works. White Castle is one of those firms that is family-owned still. Lisa Ingram is their manager today. And they have Flippy, the robot, right next to a human. White Castle, together, they make more money. And the family-owned firm lasts for 100 years, where most family-owned firms don't last that long. And that's because they bring technology in, and the people who change themselves actually do better. And nations, that's how nations make progress. It's always interesting to me is to ask the question, why are some nations rich and some poor? And the answer is, of course, because of their values, not because of their capital or their natural resources. A lot of people say the countries that are the richest, it's because of natural resources. Remember, when the U.S., almost 70% of all workers were on the farm, it didn't have any more natural resources then than it does now. But everybody, not everybody, most people are much richer today than they were when they were all working on the farm with manual labor, horses and oxen, so forth. And that's the way economists work. Now, you've got to promote that either as an individual. The second richest country in the world today on a per capita basis is Singapore. I've been to Singapore many times, jogged around. There's several things true about Singapore. There's no crime in Singapore. They don't have it. Few foreigners will get involved occasionally. They don't have poverty to speak of. There's a little bit of the city where there's some poverty, but not much. And there's no dirt. And they tried to pay people to have children because in 1950, Singapore was called a malaria-infested swampland. Today, it's the second richest after Liechtenstein country per person in the world. And they have almost 7 million people. They've gone from 1 million people to 7 million people, and they make very good money. They've gone from $400 or $500 per capita GDP to 70,000 or something like that. Let me look at the number. The last number I have for Singapore is 87,000 per household. And it's not rocket science. It's just some people call it common sense, which is not too common anymore. And that's what we try to do in the book Objective Prosperity, is take examples of individuals like Dr. Bid Carson or A.G. Gaston, or current one is David Steward, who is one of the most successful people in computer science in America, owner of WW, which did $70 billion last year. And he just went to a very inexpensive school, Central Missouri State, and started working for a railroad, and finally got enough save, he and his wife, with a mortgage and two children, to start a firm called Worldwide Technologies. Today, David Steward is, by Forbes, listed as the second richest Black person in America. And I think it's $7 billion or something like that. That's how you do it. A lot of people think, nobody told me that. I don't know. It takes knowledge and the diligence to apply that knowledge. That's why I write books, is make sure that anybody who wants the knowledge, not everybody, you can't force it down their throats. People have to decide on their own to do it. But that's the way it's done. You look at what's happening in education today. A lot of schools are not doing well. I'm teaching next week in the KIPP schools in Columbus. These are schools for kids from very low-income areas. I'll be talking to a group of seniors there, most of which are from an area of Columbus that is the lowest income in the area. About 85 to 90% of those KIPP schools are either Black or Hispanic. But 85% of those students from very poor backgrounds will graduate from college 3 or 4 years later. When I say 3 or 4, it doesn't take 4 years to get a college degree. It only takes 3. A lot of people say, I don't know how. That's because their parents or school counselors or somebody never told them how.
Let me bring this back into over the last 100 years, we've seen this shift from the farmland, agriculture to services here. Obviously, that's the huge displacement of workers and jobs in different sectors. And maybe in the last decade, or even maybe in the last year, and probably in the future with AI, we're seeing that maybe accelerate even more, that there is no blue collar, white collar anymore. And here's where my whole thesis comes into play, where I put my money on it is,
yep,
like we said earlier, like the blue collar people are getting paid more, white collar people are getting paid less. The way I see it, it's that shrinking middle class, right? It used to be that you could be a white collar worker and get paid 3x, 4x a blue collar worker. That's not the case anymore. And they are coming down and the bottom is moving up very slowly. And to me, all right, the way I'm going to put my money on it is I'm going to invest in workforce housing, right? That type of stuff.
So, well, that's
based
a good
on
point.
What you know from economics, where would you put your money, Roger?
Well, I would put my money, Clayton Christensen said well when he said, you have to know what job you perform for other people. The only people who have a right to a good living in the future are those who perform a job for some group of people and do it better than the way it's done now. But a lot of people don't know what jobs need to be done. You listen to people's problems. And if you can solve their problems, you will get a good income. It's called the jobs theory by Clayton Christensen. And what happens is if you have vacant houses or cars, somebody figure out, okay, we could rent those houses out to people, and that's the people who win. People who don't try to improve their understanding of what's happening in society and get the skills needed for that won't do as well in the future.
Roger, what would you be investing in? Like, where would you put your money as an investor?
Well, I won't mention the specific stocks, but yeah, I've had stocks that have gone up 10 times in the last less than 10 years, and they have all been doing essential services in residential housing. It's multifamily housing, as you've indicated. Building a single family in a McMansion, as they call them, that's not the right best business in the world, even though there's plenty of people who pay $20 million, $40 million, around Malibu, $100 million. But this particular company that I've invested in does roofing first, and then it does the insulation that goes inside for large residential stuff. If you think affordable housing is necessary, this firm does not the whole projects, but just does the essential part of that, roofing and insulation. And I bought the stock at 17, and the last time I looked, it was about 150, and it's within the last couple of years. How do you know that? By reading books or walking around places that are being built. Charlie Munger did it by reading books. Other people do it I walk through the malls and figure out what are people buying. And I talk to the sales clerks and say, what's really selling well? And you know whether people are buying fast fashion or high fashion. But if you don't know that, you shouldn't expect to raise your income. The middle class is shrinking, but you know where most of the middle class is shrinking to? Twice as many move up as move down. Now, there's about 20% who move down and about 40% who move up. And the middle class is getting shrunk, but it's because so many of them are moving to the upper middle. $170,000 for a truck driver is not a bad income. People can live on that. But a lot of people say, I don't want to be a truck driver, or I don't know how. That's why I think knowledge, and I like focused knowledge. I'm afraid many of our schools, I've taught at all levels, high school through PhD programs, and sometimes we just teach people what is fun to learn, is interesting, rather than what we need to be have a good career. And that's what schools should be teaching.
So let's bring this back to population, because that's something that you can see that's almost undeniable. You can see it coming through the snake as the snake eats the rat. You can see it throwing. Now everybody's talking about China's population is dwindling, right? But what's happening with America here?
If you have this chart, we used to be mostly young people. In 1900, most everybody in the United States was young. And that started changing. And then you see the next slide, I think you have, that it bulged out from young to a lot more middle. And then the last slide on that one is that there is no more mass, but the fastest growing people are the people over 65. The number one source of new workers for firms today is 55 to 64. And the second richest fast is 65 plus. See, if anybody's working for a firm and they're 65 and in reasonably good health, they got 20 more years to live. Question, what are they going to do those 20 years? Sit in your rocking chair or continue working? Most of them didn't save enough that they're going to need to continue working. But the normal age in the past of workers was 16 to 64. A very historic year happened last year. In the United States, that age group actually declined and will continue to decline. What's happened because of policy in China is happening because of affluence in the U.S. When I first started teaching, my students came from classes on average with families with 3.67 children. Today, it's 1.6 children. And that's 3.67. Now it's 1.6 and going down. The average age of first child for women today is over 30. And guess what happens? Even if they still want two or three, biology kicks in and the number of kids is going way down. If we have workers, we need them to take care of all the old people. And if we don't have enough young workers to take care of the old people, we'll have to have the robots taking care of the old people, which is happening in Japan today a lot. And I've seen it a little bit in some U.S. places, but we're not going to change the population trend. Singapore tried that. They tried paying for people to have children, and it didn't work. You cannot pay people enough to have children. China restricted population with their one-child policy. We didn't have a policy in the U.S., but we did the same thing because of sociological trends. That's why behavioral science is different than Keynesian economics. It adds to all the other things that really explain what's going on.
Yeah, basically like when people get more educated, they're like, maybe it's better to concentrate my resources from these three kids to one and a half.
Either that or when they get better educated, they figure out where the kids come from and stop having as many. Take your choice on that. But the reality is, yes, the most effective contraceptive in the world is affluence. When countries get rich, they stop having children. In the first paragraph, one of the first paragraphs of our book, we talk about economics is sometimes called the dismal science. A lot of people don't know why it's called that. Maybe they think about the quality of teachers, possibly. But really, that came from a guy by the name of Malthus, Malthusian economics. More than 200 years ago, he wrote that the world is doomed. We're raising so many people, we can't possibly feed them all. So they will die. That's not the way it works. We have today, what's America's biggest health problem? The answer is too much food. That is the single biggest health problem. Like I said, I was at the doctor's office this morning, and I taught in the Ohio State Medical School as well as the business school. And the reality is, I was working for a few years on the diabetes problem. Diabetes is probably the most expensive disease we have. It causes blindness and surgeries and all kinds of problems, heart problems, everything else. Where do you get diabetes, type 2 diabetes? The answer is overeating. Our problem in America is we got too much food and we're eating it all. And the rest of the world is becoming that way too, to some extent. these are the kind, if you solve those problems, you don't have to invent an Ozempic. You can invent a better way to eat. When I go to a restaurant, I went to a restaurant last night, grilled cheese sandwich. So I cut it in half. That's what I had for lunch today, is the other half of that grilled cheese. What happened? Two, I reduced my calories by half and I reduced my expense by half. Those are the things that cause some people to be more prosperous than other people. If you have parents that teach you that, that's good. Why do Asian Americans average about $15,000 higher than white non-Hispanics? Two reasons. One of their parents teach them the value of education. And in Jewish families, these are statistics, are even higher. And the two things that cause you to be prosperous or poor, two correlates with it. It's not the only things, of course. The two correlates are family stability, two parents present in the family, makes you about three times less likely to live in poverty, and education. And Asian Americans and Jewish families put a lot of emphasis on those two. Divorce rates are much lower in those groups. And the lower the divorce rates, the higher the prosperity rates. Those are the facts. And Sergeant Friday said, just the facts, sir, just the facts. And that's why behavioral economics is very different than Keynesian economics. Keynesian economics is basically mathematical. We do a mathematical, and that's good. We have the precision that mathematics provide, except you always end up, one variable is a function of another variable, holding constant everything else, like consumer preferences or consumer income. I remember sitting in an economics class when the professor was putting this downward sloping demand curve. I looked at it and he said, holding constant consumer preferences. And since I was going to teach marketing, I thought, wait a minute, that's what marketing is all about, is changing consumer preferences. And the people who know how to do that are going to make more than people who know how to change a wrench that's used for tightening a machine. These are just the facts, sure, just the facts. And I believe that there is a market today for people knowing more about the facts, because after quite a few years teaching in some great schools like Stanford and Washington and Northwestern, I taught in all of those. And I spent 40 years at Ohio State, which is a great public institution. You know what? We aren't teaching people the facts as much as opinions. And that's where people get into trouble.
I think we've reached the top of the hour. Appreciate you coming on, Roger. If everybody wants to pick up his book, Objective Prosperity, on Amazon, there it is. Or you can check out his website, rogerblackwellbusiness.com. Any parting words?
About the only people who succeed are those who plan to. And it takes no more effort to plan than it does to dream. Treat every person you meet with respect and kindness. Second rule is, when people treat you with a lack of respect and kindness, go back and reread rule number one. How much trouble would we be having in Israel today if everybody treated everybody else with respect and kindness? Dave Thomas only had a 10th grade education, yet he became very affluent as a person with many millions with Wendy's restaurants. And he listed all his values and so forth, but he would come to my class and lecture on it. And sometimes the kids would say, what's the secret? And his answer was, just be nice. Just be nice. That's the key.
Thanks, everybody, for joining. Thanks, Roger. And we'll see you guys next time.